Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. This past January 25th, I had the opportunity to host an event as a benefit for KPFA-FM in Berkeley with Thomas Frank, whose latest book is titled Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Thomas Frank is also the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, several other works, editor of The Baffler. After a half-hour talk, Thomas Frank and I began to discuss his book and politics in America, and this is that discussion. I was talking online with a friend of mine who seems to have swallowed the Ron Paul Kool-Aid. What the hell is that about? There's an entire group of people out there who used to be left-wingers, and suddenly they're talking about the only solution is the elimination of the Fed.
And did they tell you about fiat money? Did he give you the line about fiat money? Oh, well, the gold standard. You know, we got to get back on the gold standard. Why do that? Just get on the euro. That would really screw us up. You know, I always wonder. It's actually much more practical. We could get on the euro tomorrow. Gold standard would be tough.
Where's all this coming from?
Ron Paul is attractive. First of all, a lot of liberals go for Ron Paul because he talks a real good line on foreign policy. And when I've been to see Ron, he does. I've seen him speak many times. And I'll tell you, Ron Paul is one of the only politicians, is the only politician I've ever seen in a speech in the year 2008, I think. It was in 2009, denounced World War I. It was incredible. And I was this was at CPAC, a Conservative Political Action Conference. And I was sitting there in the... You guys have probably never been to CPAC, but it has two main groups that go there, the donors to conservative causes who tend to be very wealthy, and then these college students who have a lot of energy. And it's about the vast majority is the college students, okay? But the rich donors all sit in this one section, and for whatever reason, they put me there, too. The journalists were sitting there, too. And Ron Paul was giving this speech, and the donors were so – they hated him. They were just like totally quiet. They would not cheer. But behind us – it was like a standing O for everything he said, and including the foreign policy stuff, which they can't stand. The Republican Party just can't stand this stuff. But hey, someone like me hears that, and it rings true. And I'll tell you what else. The Ron Paul people have had a presence at every Tea Party rally since the very beginning. That first one that I went to in February of 2009, that's who was there. And they had a sign, and I'm a pretty hardcore liberal, and I like to think I know something about economics, but I was so pissed off back then. I was so angry about the bailouts and the situation that we were in and the way things were unfolding. And I remember going to this Tea Party rally, and my cynicism was up, and I knew who these people were, and I was ready to laugh at them. And someone was holding a sign that said, "Let the failures fail." Let the failures fail. It had the AIG logo, it had the Citibank logo, and I'm like, God damn it, why not? Why not? I hate those. Let them fail. You know, now, if you go back and think about it, that's probably not the best idea. You can't just let it all collapse. But you could. There's all sorts of other steps you could have taken in between, you know, what is it, making AIG's counterparties whole to the tune of 100 cents on the dollar, and then you're just doing absolutely nothing. You know, those shouldn't be our only two choices. But if that's the option, you know, that's pretty attractive. And by the way, I've experienced the same thing as you, not with my personal friends, but there, Lord knows there's many, many reasonable people in this country. They hear this stuff, and it sounds really damn good. When I'm on the radio, I always get someone calling in and demanding wants to know when we're going to get back on the gold standard, because that's the only thing that's going to solve our problems, when we're going to end the Fed, because Lord knows the Fed is in the hands of the banksters. And if we could just tear down the state, that would finally solve all of these problems that we're in. And in the absence of everything else, it's really attractive. That is the operative part, in the absence of everything else. And there is no, I like Occupy Wall Street too, but for 3 years there was nothing else. You think about the various attempts that were made to try to build a kind of counter-narrative to the Tea Party movement. I mean, what was there? There was virtually nothing. There was John Stewart's rally to restore sanity, you know. You know, and the parties that you would ordinarily go to for something like that, like Acorn and the labor movement, were just out there getting wailed on. I mean, these guys went after every target right off the... I'm sorry, I talked so much from that little question.
Where does Occupy go from there? I mean, we've still got this big disconnect. It hasn't stopped. Obama is still in the same place.
Geithner is still there.
Yeah.
After all
yeah.
these years, Geithner is still there.
Obama is making some rhetorical concessions. I picked up the Wall Street Journal this morning. It says on the front page, Obama has become a populist overnight. By some standards, I guess he is, right? He's calling for a greater graduated tax on the wealthy. But the thing is, today people are, they're so far beyond that. They're saying, why do we have graduated income tax at all? Let him get out there, and he's got so much work to do. He's got to get out there and rationalize why we even have the damn thing. This is how they dropped the ball in the debate over health care. This is sort of the germ of the book. This is where I got the ideas. I was listening to one of those angry town hall meetings in the summer of 2009 and watching this great victory of 2008 slip through the Democrats' fingers. You know, how could they screw this up? And I was listening to this town hall meeting, and I forget what member of Congress it was, but he was addressing this audience of very angry people. By and large, they seemed like conservatives, but you don't really know because you've never met them. And he wanted to talk, as we say in Washington, he wanted to get into the weeds. He only wanted to talk about the details of the policy and what the experts said. You know, this is good in this way, this is good in this way, this is advantages, disadvantages. And the people kept saying, it was the same questions that he kept getting asked. What about freedom? What about big government? We're afraid of big government. And what about, what about personal liberty and all these sorts of things? And I was listening to this, and I'm like, he should hit that one out of the park. This doesn't limit human freedom. This expands human freedom, for God's sakes. I was at the post office here in San Francisco today, wherever we are, Berkeley, California. It was in San Francisco, but they had the four freedoms on the wall. Freedom from want. These guys can't even talk about that. They don't even know what that is. You know, the idea that they could be doing something, that enhances freedom. That you need the state, that it's not an act of totalitarianism when you enforce laws against fraud, for God's sakes. But needless to say, he never said anything like that. And I went back and I listened, while I was writing this book, I listened to a whole bunch of these town hall meetings, and they all failed in the same way. People would ask these basic questions, and I think reasonable questions, given what you were hearing on TV and from Fox News, reasonable things to be asking. And never could these guys give them a straight answer. They wanted to know about the most fundamental things about democracy, right? And about 20th century government, and why we aren't in the 19th century anymore. And Democrats could not answer, and they still can't answer. And that's the Achilles heel.
It seems to be the explanation, the rationalization for Obama, which is, okay, he's coddling Wall Street, but on the other hand, what can he do with Congress?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the question.
And the ultimate rationalization is President Santorum. And look, and I think about that all the time. It's massively frustrating, and in some ways it's already slipped through his fingers. I mean, he lost in 2010. He lost in this momentous way. And we lost I don't have anything to do with it. They lost all across the country in state legislatures all over America. You know, the Democrats dropping the ball in that kind of situation is almost unthinkable to me, but that is nevertheless what happened. I mean, what can he do now? I mean, he has to turn the game around. And he doesn't have many tools at his disposal, but for God's sakes, the man is the most gifted orator I've ever seen in my lifetime. He has that. And he's amazing, and he's a brilliant man. And you know what else? And I'm going to get a little cynical and mean here. He really has no excuse for not knowing what I've talked about tonight. That is not just me writing Pity the Billionaire or What's the Matter with Kansas. My friend Rick Perlstein has written the same thing in an 800-page biography of Richard Nixon. It's all there. There's lots of academics that write about conservatism now. This is what these guys do. The naivete. I like Barack Obama a lot, or I did back in 2008. But the naivete of going to Washington with your eye on a grand bargain, which is what he did, and looking out over this political landscape, this economic landscape where the country has been brought to ruin by epic fraud on Wall Street, and saying, oh, you know what really ails us? Is incivility in Washington. Partisanship. I live in Washington, and yes, partisanship is stupid. It's possibly the dumbest thing ever invented. I mean, they have like Republican softball games and Democratic softball games. It's incredibly stupid, and people are so mean to each other. Yes, we all know it's stupid, but the real problem was not that, and it still isn't that. The real problem is up in New York City. You know, it's these investment banks, Greenwich, Connecticut. Go do something about it. It was that kind of naivety has served him very poorly ever since then. Look, the man can still recover. The election's coming up. At least they didn't do their, you know, the debt ceiling thing where they threatened to tank the U.S. economy once and for all. They didn't do that. He can turn this thing around, but he has to get smart really, really fast.
Then, Thomas Frank, on the other hand, there's the Republicans running for president as well, and you were on KPFA this morning and talked about how impressive you think Gingrich has become.
Gingrich is right out of Pity the Billionaire, you know. He's been running these commercials in South Carolina that were denouncing Romney, denouncing Bain Capital as, what did he call it, vulture capitalism. And if you put aside, there's a little disclaimer at the beginning. He's like, well, we all believe in capitalism, you know, but some things are not true capitalism, which is always what they say, of course. This is right. This is the Tea Party. Some things aren't true capitalism. But then he goes on to this, like, you know, incredible denunciation of Bain Capital. That's like, I mean, it's like I could have written it. It's like it's extraordinary. It's way to the left of anything that any Democrat, with a few exceptions, is saying right now. Newt Gingrich is saying that. He has completely swiped the historical left. The really hilarious thing is I have a friend who's a Romney supporter, and he called me up the other day, and he was really upset when Gingrich won the South Carolina primary. He's like, and it was all because of these commercials, you know. And he was like, doesn't Gingrich understand? He says he loves Ronald Reagan. Well, Romney is the fruit of Ronald Reagan's policies. It is Reagan that gave us, you know, leveraged buyouts. And, you know, all of these things would have been, that was what the Reagan Revolution was all about. How can he say this? Because he wants to win, duh. He wants to win. You know, you've got all this great imagery of the left, you know, and nobody's using it. You know, after the Wrecking Crew, I said I would never write another book about politics. I was so sick of it. And you understand why. I mean, I did all that research on Jack Abramoff and on all the machinations of conservative D.C., and it was so loathsome and so filthy. And I wanted to never have anything to do with it ever again. And then the Tea Party movement happened, and I was writing for the Wall Street Journal. I had to do it. I had to start writing about it again. But I swear I won't anymore, unless Newt gets elected.
Where is there an articulation of a progressive perspective and program to be found? How can we find it? And how does the media play into all this as well?
I make a lot of fun of Democrats. There are good Democrats out there. I like Elizabeth Warren. I think she's really awesome. And you know what else? She was a high school debater in Oklahoma and a conservative when she was... But she didn't get to wear these little collar bars. Only we got to wear those. But that was our sport, you know, in Kansas and Oklahoma. That's what we did. Is, you know, the conservatives would yell at one another and get dressed up and all that sort of thing. So, but where can it be found? I like what I saw from, you know, Occupy Wall Street, as long as they aren't, you know, punching out cops and setting things on fire and stuff like that. I like the I Am the 99% campaign. That was really awesome. But we have to recognize the limitations of that. It is a beginning. It's just the start. It was a cry of desperation. Now, it was a really eloquent cry of desperation. I mean, I was looking at that, and I just couldn't believe it. It was very powerful. And the same is true with those great protests in Madison, Wisconsin, against Scott Walker. I went out there and, yeah. I was out there covering those, and it was super impressive. But it was... people whose backs are to the wall, you know, trying to defend their way of life. It's just the beginning. And we have to build from that. And ultimately, the answer is that we're not going to get an answer from the Democratic Party. That's not where the answer comes from. The answer has to come from outside them. It has to come from us. There has to be movement building. You think about the 30s. Franklin Roosevelt was a great president and a great man. But he was also constantly being pushed by people outside the traditional political process. Labor unions, for example, which, by the way, he made that possible. He encouraged people to join labor unions. He made it the case that you couldn't just shoot people down in the street anymore when they tried to form a labor union. Barack Obama could have done that with card check, and he really dropped the ball on that one. I mean, we have to take it into our own hands. You think about, I mean, a guy like Huey Long, who we think of today as this crazy demagogue, but he had followers all over America. Do you remember what his slogan was? Share the wealth. I mean, you talk about class warfare. Jesus Christ, this guy was extraordinary. Or the guy that with the old age pensions. What was his name? Townsend, Dr. Townsend. You know, had this enormous movement. All these people signed up for this guy. And that was sort of the kernel of Social Security. Or Upton Sinclair here in California. What I'm getting at is there was lots of movement building outside of the traditional Democratic Party. And that's super important. And that's the next step. And just camping out in a public space, that's a great start. It's like the Bonus Army in 1932. But the Bonus Army did not end well. Okay? It has to become relevant to people at the level of their everyday lives in the way that organized labor used to be. And that's tricky, but that's what we got to do somehow.
You're listening to a discussion before a live audience with Thomas Frank, whose latest book is Pity the Billionaire.
It seems to me that Jane Mayer's outing of the Koch brothers last year changed things. Do you think it did?
You don't say my outing of them in What's the Matter with Kansas, because it wasn't that important back then. This is the Koch brothers were I researched them for What's the Matter with Kansas, but they weren't big players in 2004. They were far smaller, lesser deal in Washington than like the Scaifes or the Coors family or stuff like that. But then they, just in the last couple of years, they've grown to be gigantic. They are the number one funding group. But that was a great article. Jane Mayer, she's awesome. And it did change things in the sense that it put the focus on, there's this sort of malign power behind the throne, the kind of William Randolph Hearst power. But there's a lot of that these days. We need a lot more exposés like that. I would also caution people against, blaming everything on the billionaire puppet masters behind the scenes. Because as we all know from cultural studies, that's not how it all works. There has to be a lot of enthusiasm coming from the grassroots up. And that does exist. It is out there. But at the same time, we need lots more exposés like that. That's the only answer. Yes, it changed the way people talk about things, and we need lots more of that. One more thing about them. The Weekly Standard, this is one of the moments of billionaire pitying that's possibly the most amusing. The Weekly Standard ran a cover story about the Koch brothers. It showed them being burned at the stake, like Joan of Arc, right? Martyrs for the cause. Pity the billionaire, my friend.
This book, Pity the Billionaire, pretty much says that they put the whole moral agenda aside, but we're seeing a return to that in the area of gay marriage and the return of the evangelicals, and I just wonder if that's going to come right back in.
The culture wars, yeah, they'll definitely be back. I think my feeling is that the culture wars won't be back the way they used to be until you get back to better times. This is, again, the example of the 20s and the 30s, the 20s when you had all sorts of culture wars, prohibition, evolution, all sorts of crazy things going on. And once the Depression started, they just dropped that stuff like a hot potato, immediately overturned prohibition. And I think in times like the present, it's natural and normal that the economic message is first and foremost. And that's, by the way, that's what the Tea Party movement always claims. It's like, we're not about the culture wars. And I went to a bunch of Tea Party rallies, and that does indeed seem to be the case. I did not see, I don't think I saw any anti-abortion placards at a Tea Party rally. I mean, you never heard about culture war issues from the lectern. It's always these economic things. But that said, they don't understand economic, they don't talk about economic issues in an economic way. They talk about them as moral issues. This gets back to your Ron Paul thing. One of the things that makes Ron Paul so powerful is that in his vision, we are... Remember I used that word liquidationists? Herbert Hoover called them liquidationists. It was Andrew Mellon's great idea in the Depression was just let it go. Don't do anything. Don't raise a finger. Let the economy hit bottom. And then people will start to come back. But don't even try to rescue anybody. Let everyone get destroyed. Liquidate them all. And that's Ron Paul's way of looking at it. He's something of a liquidation. He uses the word liquidation all the time. He said in their debate in Florida, we need to let it liquidate. And what's attractive by that is this grand moral sense that we have lived too high on the hog for too long. And now the check has come. Now the bill is here. And his son, Rand Paul, always talks about what he calls a day of judgment. And there's this supremely moral overtone to that. And this is really how they talk about economics. We ran up all this debt. We had a really good time, and now the party needs to come to an end. Okay, and this, I mean, elides all these, I'm at Berkeley so I can say elides. It elides all these different, you know, species of debt, government debt, private debt, you know, the debt that Mitt Romney ran up when he was doing leveraged buyouts, which is a lot, by the way. That's what leveraged buyouts are, the leverage in leverage. Anyhow, but that debt is apparently not a problem. But it's a very moral and superstitious way of looking at the economy. It's like a biblical way of looking at the economy. It's extremely powerful, but it's not in economic terms. It's a load of Santorum. You know, it means nothing. Economists laugh at it. You know, I was writing a story about Ron Paul's liquidationism for Harper's Magazine, and it's like I try to get economists to talk about this, and they're like, God, you know, it's just nonsense. It's, you know, everyone knows it.
David Brooks talks about, well, if we go back to some kind of social safety net, then we'll just turn into Europe, as if Europe has now become...
Yeah, our allies. They're the ones that helped us beat the Soviets, aren't they, and beat the Nazis and all that. Aren't they our friends? But they also want what's happened to Europe to happen to us. These guys, I mean, the situation that Greece, Spain, Italy, Ireland are in, and Portugal are in, is very different than the situation that we're in. They really are trapped in a kind of 1932 situation in the way that we were trapped because of the gold standard. And they can't get out of it because they don't control their own currency. In fact, you might say none of them control their own currency except for maybe the Germans and the French. And that's why they are in such a... I mean, you look at a country like Spain. I used to go on vacation there every year, and they were so proud, you know, of their growing economy. And they played the game, but they played by the rules, you know, by the IMF's rules. They were very cautious, and they didn't have huge deficits. But, you know, hard times comes along, and all that's gone. You know, suddenly the tax revenues fall through the floor, and they're in huge, huge trouble. And they can't get out of it because they're stuck with the euro. Okay. I mean, their problem is very different from ours, and they really are facing, you know, some kind of, you know, end of the world sort of disaster over there. And that what's amusing to me is that when we conflate Europe and ourselves, these pundits, often like David Brooks, think that's what's going to happen to us, and it's not. Our problems are completely different. I get sick of even talking about it, but you cannot persuade these people. I'm sorry. Of course, I can persuade them. That's why I write books.
Well, that's
why I write these articles every month. I have to keep trying and trying and trying.
Does it work? I mean, have you persuaded people?
You know, what is it? When Mitt Romney was a missionary in France,
yeah.
Didn't he converted something like, he was there for 2 years and converted something like 8 people. And that was regarded as a great success. As a great success. It's a very, you know, it's a very Catholic country. That would be a very hard thing to do. And, I don't even know if I've converted that many. I'm such a liberal at the end of the day. I'm so sorry. You know, because that's what we do, right? That's what we do, is we sit around and we laugh and we write books that I always talk about our failings, the failings of the liberal movement in this country, and that our model for it is academia. Our model for it, that's our model. You look at Occupy Wall Street, and they have panel discussions. You know, we all think that we're like sitting in a library doing the research that's going to refute the other guy's research. That's what we think we're doing. The old model used to be the labor movement. We're all in this together. We show some solidarity and we'll get something, you know. Direct action gets the goods. We don't think that way anymore. It's always about, you know, I'm going to write my little book. And I have to say, I'm the worst offender in this regard. I know better, but, you know, that's where I am. That's what I do.
What do you envision, Thomas Frank, as some kind of alternative narrative? Because obviously, as you said, on one side we've got the right and we've got power to the rich. And on the other side, what do we have? And where do we go?
At the end of the day, I'm a New Dealer. That's the social philosophy that appeals to me. And I was just, God, I was just in that post office with the 4 freedoms on the wall. The first thing that you have to do, I mean, is negative, and that is to tear down the myth of the free market, okay, the myths of the market. And this needs to be destroyed, you know. And I mean, look, the tools are at hand. I mean, my God, the evidence is all around us today. And, I, you know, I basically started my career in journalism and in writing books by writing about market failures. That's what One Market Under God is about market failures. And, you know, they were epidemic at the time. This is in the 90s, the sort of golden age of the free market faith. I mean, what do we say now when it is all collapsed around us? It all lies in ruins on the floor. How can anybody really believe in the free market myth in that kind of situation? That's the first order of business, is to just destroy that myth, okay? And that takes a big national conversation. And I like to say I am trying to do my part, you know. God, with this book, with what I write in Harper's, you know, with everything that I do. But it takes people much bigger than me. And it takes a narrative. I mean, I don't want to say it takes a Fox News, but it kind of does, you know. It takes some kind of popular, massive, you know, literature that is acceptable to everyone. You know, it's not something that is self-evident. This is another mistake, I think, the mistake that Democrats make. Democrats have all these different species of fatalism that they're sort of guilty of. And one of them is forever assuming that it's all self-evident. You know, of course, no, you know, I think Barack Obama was, this is one of his failings, is that he thinks he doesn't have to make the argument I just described. He doesn't have to because it's so obvious. You know, he doesn't have to go there. Besides, going there would also cost him in financial contributions. If he did, if he made the argument I'm saying, he could forget about those wonderful donors and his friends in Lower Manhattan that, you know, he loves to have those, you know, the dinners where you have to pay $30,000 to eat dinner with him and that sort of thing, or whatever the hell it is. Now, I'm a little bitter about this because he interrupted it. I went to Chicago the other day to give a lecture in the South Side in my old haunts down in Hyde Park. They closed down Lakeshore Drive. Nobody could get to my event. Why'd they close down Lakeshore Drive? Barack Obama was down there having dinner at the home of a venture capitalist, you know, raising money. And he will not be able to have those dinners if he makes that argument. If he does not make that argument, you know, you can forget about, the safety net. You can forget about an elementary, you know, regulated economy. These people are on the attack. You can forget about beating them.
And then on top of that comes SOPA and PIPA and where are the Democrats?
You know, what really burns me up is the civil liberty stuff. I thought he was going to repeal the Patriot Act. And this is actually, you know, This annoys me every day. I sometimes cannot believe the country that we've become. Not because we have, you know, national health care in this country. That's not why we have the, you know, creeping Big Brotherism. We have it because of this stupid, you know, war on terrorism. I mean, it's not a stupid war. Terrorism is bad. Yes, I understand that. But it's because of the national security state that we're doing this. I admit, this is not a practical political issue, this commitment to civil liberties. It's not an overwhelmingly popular thing. But look at the present situation. The Tea Party movement is forthrightly libertarian. They always are worried about totalitarianism, and they're worried about Big Brother coming to get them. Why not pass universal health care and repeal the Patriot Act at the same time and at least make these guys' worldview a little bit difficult, you know? At least problematize it a little bit for these guys. They're all out there worried about Big Brother. Take a huge sledgehammer to Big Brother. It would be awesome. And it would be politically smart at this moment, given that his opponents are these libertarians.
I just was handed something which says, aren't you describing history as propaganda, purposely delivered by PR pros and myopic pundits? Isn't conservatism just a reinvented frame for a marriage between Wall Street and truly big government? And isn't this on some level fascism?
That is a good question. I wouldn't use that word. Because I think fascism entails a lot of other things. Fascism entails street gangs. Fascism entails, you know, well, I always think it entails rampant anti-Semitism, but there were some fascist groups that weren't. But it does entail a master race. You know, all your species of fascism had that. And the libertarianism, this is the funny thing, is that this marriage of state and Wall Street has happened under the auspices of a movement that's all about human freedom, free markets being the very essence of freedom. And then they capture the state. You know, I think about fascism a lot. When I started writing Pity the Billionaire, that was going to be my frame of reference. And so I went back and did all this research about 30s fascist movements. And I even read a French fascist novel in French, because, of course, it's never been translated. Man, it was crap. It was total Santorum. And
how does it compare to Atlas Shrugged?
I have a lot of theories about Atlas Shrugged. You'll probably want to come to that. Look, I shouldn't make light of this stuff because it is terrifying at all sorts of levels. And it's especially terrifying to see that this candidate who you really counted on and who you really thought his heart was in the right place and who you really thought was going to be able to nail this stuff, to see him completely sucked into that system. Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, you know, every compromise, always a compromise in the direction of those guys. And those guys still writing these letters to Obama, don't say mean things about the billionaires. Cry hot tears for the billionaires. It is absolutely infuriating. And for reasons I don't want to go into here, I know I hear all kinds of Washington scuttlebutt about economic policy making. And it is always, always, always concessions to Wall Street. They dasn't do anything that makes these people mad. Ever, 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 ever. It drives me crazy. Okay, take another step back. Franklin Roosevelt, my hero. And he becomes more of a hero to me every time I think about this. When he came into office in 1933, the nation's banking system was in ruins. In fact, the day he was sworn in, banks in America were closed. And he took that opportunity not to just set Wall Street back up on its feet and get it going again, but to completely reorganize the economics of this country, okay? And they rebuilt the financial system of this country from the ground up. And they did it however they chose. He had I often mention this in the context of bailouts, because Hoover did a lot of bailouts. And Hoover didn't make any conditions, just give those guys the money. Roosevelt didn't accept those bailouts and say, oh, yes, in the spirit of bipartisanship, and, you know, because I know that there's no red America, no blue America, but just one, you know, United States of America, I will keep doing this policy or some, you know, Santorum like that. No, he denounced the bailouts. He denounced the Hoover administration's bailouts, and he talked about how outrageous and unfair they were. And when he got into office, he kept doing bailouts, but he didn't do them in the same way. And this is the lost opportunity. This is what we never even, our columnists and our pundits at the time of 2008 never even mentioned this possibility. You know, there's all sorts of ways to do a bailout. So Roosevelt's people continued the bailouts. But you know what else they did? They would go in there, and when they bailed out a bank, they would fire all the management. Or they'd go into a city, yeah! they'd go into a city and they did not like the banks in that city because they had taken on too risky investments, and they'd say, well, we're starting a new bank. And they actually did that. They capped compensation. They did that all the time. Capped compensation for Wall Street people. Of course, they broke up Wall Street. You know, the investment, the Glass-Steagall Act. They put up the FDIC. You know, they set up the Securities and Exchange Commission, and when they did their bailouts, they liked to bail things out from the bottom up. So they would go to mom-and-pop SNLs, they would go to cattle auction marts out on the Great Plains, little small-town financial operations, and that's who they bailed out. Okay? And they did this deliberately to rebuild the economy without... Remember what Roosevelt's term was? I was trying to remember what his term was. They were the high priests of our civilization, have abandoned their station in the temple. And we were going to continue without those guys. And that was heavy-handed. And that was big government. But you know what? It was right. And it worked. And for 40 or 50 years, we lived in that America. And we didn't have financial panics. And we didn't have financial crises. And now it's, you know, the more we've deregulated and the more Wall Street has conquered our government, the worse it's got. And you look at that opportunity in 2008 and 2009, and you're like, why the hell didn't we take that opportunity? That's the moment when a pundit could have made a difference, if somebody had just talked about this. But, you know, there is still a chance. There's still a chance, and somehow we've got to make the Democratic Party, or whoever, maybe we'll get liberal Republicans again, but somebody's got to come out there and do this thing. We've got to rebuild this economy in a different way.
You've been listening to a discussion recorded January 25th, 2012, in front of a live audience as a benefit for KPFA FM in Berkeley, with Thomas Frank, whose latest book is Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.